Hello, it's Thursday the 24th of June. I'm Jim White, sitting in for the main man, and this is the Andrew Pearce Show, direct from the Daily Mail newsroom. On the agenda today, should the High Street Bank be placed on the endangered species list? As another round of closures is announced by Lloyds, we ask, will popping into your local branch soon become a thing of the past? Also, it's been proposed that children should be taught how to become climate protesters on the national curriculum. Really? And the British tech entrepreneur John McAfee has taken his own life in a Spanish jail. Who was he? And how did things go so wrong for him? We'll be finding out. The USA is currently gripped by the case brought by the singer Britney Spears against the conservatorship that has governed her life for the last 13 years. In an impassioned testimony in court on Wednesday, she described it as an abusive arrangement that has denied her basic human rights. The conservatorship has given her father Jamie Spears, together with a corporate fiduciary known as Bessemer Trust and a licensed conservator, control over her estate, career and medical care, but also aspects of her personal life. I want to be able to get married and have a baby, she told the court. I was told right now in the conservatorship I am not able to get married or have a baby. So how did it come to this? How can such restraint be exercised? And is it likely that it's going to be ended by a court judgment? With me to discuss all this is Rory Lynch, who's reputation and privacy lawyer with the leading UK and international law firm Vardags. Rory, thanks for joining us. Why is Britney under this conservatorship?
So Britney was placed under this conservatorship in 2008 by her father, Jamie Spears, due to mental health reasons. If you remember, back in 2008, she had a very well-publicized divorce and she lost custody of her two sons. This sadly affected her mental health and she was admitted to hospital a couple of times. And there are also some quite high-profile incidences reported which suggested she'd lost mental capacity. Initially, the conservatorship was just temporary, and it was for her finances as well as medical decisions, but it was made permanent subsequently. The medical reasons are not public, but her father had stressed her vulnerability in making financial decisions that could lead to her being taken advantage of.
Yeah, I understand that. I understand financial arrangements. It's a sort of extended power of attorney, as it were. But how come it's got this restraint on her private life? That seems to be not really justified, is it?
Yeah, so the system in the US is certainly different to the system we have in the UK. Now, in the UK, the equivalent is called deputyship. And the Court of Protection would grant powers for a deputy normally to be a suitable professional with experience to sort of handle the individual's affairs. However, strangely, in this case, in the US, this power is given to her father. Also, in the UK system, under the Mental Capacity Act, the deputies must adhere to strict rules to protect the individual's basic rights and freedoms and that they're not restricted. So there's basically a high standard of care in place when making decisions. This is to, you know, safeguard the person. So it is strange that in the US, there's this ability for a conservator to have very firm control over a person's private life. And certainly what Britney described is very distressing. And this does seem like a very draconian system in the US, that there is scope to be able to do that.
It's a draconian system, but can she fight against it? I mean, has she got a chance of getting this overturned, do you feel?
Right, so this is where, from a legal perspective, it's slightly odd in terms of her testimony yesterday. So obviously these laws are in place to protect people who don't have mental capacity. Now, seemingly, Britney does have mental capacity now, and therefore what she needs to do is petition to have the conservatorship overturned based on the fact that she's got mental capacity. Now, in order to do that, and understandably, the court will need assessments of her mental health from an independent doctor or psychiatrist. Now, she's asking for it to be overturned without her being evaluated. Now, this is slightly odd because if she does have mental capacity, which seemingly she does, then why not be assessed? And then if she's assessed and she gets the all clear, then it can be ended. So that's what's slightly odd about this case from a legal perspective.
Listen, pop music has always been run by the old dictum, where there's a hit, there's a writ. Do you think ultimately this is about finance? It's about her dad using her as a commodity to make money?
Well, it's a very interesting point there, actually, because the difference, again, between the two systems, in the UK, if you're a deputy, any expenses exceeding £500 must be explained to the Court of Protection. However, in the US, Britney's conservators have been able to take a percentage of her income. Now, in the UK, that would be considered in the best interest of the individual. But what there seems to be in America is a cottage industry whereby the conservators and all the professional advisors who they instruct are able to make quite a lot of money out of the conservatorship. And it's all the money of the person who is under the conservatorship. So there is certainly a strong indication here that Jamie Spears, although undoubtedly he has the welfare of his child at heart, he also has benefited from it financially, as have all the other advisors involved.
Really interesting that, Rory. Which way do you reckon, where are your instincts lie into where this will go over the next couple of weeks?
So I find it odd that she hasn't just petitioned to end the conservatorship based on her mental health. She seems to want to end it without being evaluated, which just simply won't happen, and rightly so. But she's also asked for the conservator to be changed to a care assistant who she knows. I think that she's worried about being evaluated. It may be that although on the surface she does seem fine, there may be still some concerns about her mental health and her ability to run her affairs. So it may be that she's going for the lesser approach, in a sense of having a kind of friendly conservator who will treat her with more respect and allow her to have more freedoms. She will need to be evaluated by an independent doctor in order to end the conservatorship. If she doesn't, which appears to be the case, then it looks like she'll probably have good grounds to change the conservator to this friendly care assistant, because it would appear that she has been taken advantage of by her father and the other conservators.
Well, whatever happens, it's going to be an interesting Christmas in the Spears household, isn't it? My thanks to Rory Lynch there, reputation and privacy lawyer. Visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with all our other podcasts and video series. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. We've seen it so often in our high streets, former banks being turned into pubs and wine bars. And there'll be a lot more of it happening soon. Lloyds Banking Group has announced plans to close another 44 high street branches of Lloyds and Halifax over the next 12 months. The lender said that the cuts are in response to a shift in customer behaviour, with digital banking soaring during the pandemic. Indeed, over the past 5 years, those of us using apps on our phones to do our banking has risen from 4 million to 18 million. And all this comes after Santander announced in late March this year the closure of 111 branches across the country due to the shift to mobile and online banking. So is the high street bank doomed? Welcome, Karen Evans, National Officer for the Finance Section of the Unite Union. Karen, Lloyds have said that nobody working in branches that close will be made forcibly redundant. So what will your members do instead?
So that's correct. Lloyds have been working with Unite and the other trade unions to minimise any redundancies. So there will be some voluntary redundancies, and other people that work in branches will be redeployed. So they'll be doing like telephone banking, working in call centres and that kind of thing. So it'll be vastly different for those members of staff from the role that they're currently doing.
But it's not just the staff who are affected by this. I mean, how does a bank closing, do you think, affect the community that it served?
So, you know, for me, I think a big thing here is the fact that the Lloyds Bank Group are saying Trade's dropped off, for want of a better word, you know, so not too many customers attending during the pandemic. Really, it's a pandemic. Nobody's been going nowhere. We've been locked up for nearly 18 months. So for me, I think, you know, people need to be able to access cash. That's both the public and local business owners. I actually think that, you know, branches are a vital resource post-pandemic. People will have all sorts of financial issues. Businesses like to take out loans, and those loans are due to be repaid, so they're going to need to start talking to people. People have had mortgage breaks. People are in all sorts of debt because they've either lost their job or been furloughed and been on less pay than they were before. All of these individuals need to be able to go into a branch. They need to be able to have that face-to-face contact, to be able to speak to a professional person who can give them the proper support they need for their financial future. And I think, you know, that's a massive, massive role that the high street branches of banks need to be playing post-pandemic. I mean, the LBG message is we're helping Britain recover, but if they're closing branches left, right and centre, I fail to see how that message is helpful.
It also seems to me, I may be wrong about this, but it seems to me it's older people and those without access to technology who are being unduly affected by that. I mean, does the bank simply not care about its older customers?
So the bank's message, and it's not for me to give the bank's message out clearly, but the bank will say that they are doing things to help older citizens. They're trialling branches within post office. That can be quite confusing for people, I've been told. They just see a drop in footfall in their branches, and kind of, you're right, it's older people, it's people who are wary of using the internet for stuff in case they get scammed. A lot of older people still want to just go in and, you know, pay the council tax or pay the gas and electric bill. So it will impact on them. I believe Lloyd is saying nobody will have to travel more than 5 miles to a branch. But again, if you're an elderly person, you're relying on public transport, you're somebody that's like really, you know, feeling the pinch because of the pandemic, to say it's only 5 miles away if you haven't got a car or you can't afford public transport, it's just, you know, 5 miles is 5 miles. I wouldn't want to walk it to go to the bank.
I was being slightly sarcastic maybe when I said that all these banks are turning into wine bars, but do you think that they're trying to actually capitalise on their property portfolio here?
So I don't know the answers to that one. I mean, obviously, all of these banks are worth a significant amount of money in some locations. I'm sure we can all think of a high street brand of pub that often buys up banks and turns them into a very posh pub, although it's not particularly posh, it's quite economical, if you know what I mean. I'm trying not to say the name of the brand. there is potential for them to be turned into exactly that, pub and wine bars. I mean, dependent on the size, I don't know, they could be turned into just about anything, couldn't they? But it would generate a lot of income on the property portfolio. I don't honestly know if that's the reason behind it. I don't think so. I think it is a genuine cut in foot flow. But I think just Lloyd's need to look outside the box somewhat. Everywhere's had a drop in people attending businesses because of the pandemic, and one day we're all going to be allowed to go back outside and be normal, and you know, people will get back to the high street and they will need their bank.
But do you think, Karen, finally, do you think that the end is nigh for the high street bank? Do you think this is, in the next 10 years we won't have any anywhere?
Well, I think I really, really hope not, because on a personal level, I can only talk on a personal level. I've recently had to do, because of the pandemic, a mortgage via the telephone and email and text messages. And I have to say, I found that the most horrible, impersonal way of doing anything. I appreciate people think all these modern, snazzy online banks are the way to go. And I'm sure, I'm sure it does save banks lots of money from having to have people in branches. But, you know, there is always a need to talk to somebody about your finance, and not just somebody on the phone. That can be so impersonal, where you passed from your phone today and you speak to John, and then your phone tomorrow and you speak to Teresa, and then you have the phone again and you get Mary. Do you know what I mean? It's like you don't have one point of contact. I just think it's very impersonal. I think I understand about less people going in, but I think they've got a massive, massive part to play in our communities. And I think it'll be a sad day when we've got no branches or banks on the high street.
A sad day indeed. Thanks very much to Karen Evans there, the National Officer for the Finance Section of the Unite Union. And if you want to get in touch, you can tweet us at MailPlus, or you can get hold of Andrew at ToryBoyPierce. A new survey conducted by the University of Bristol, which sought the views of some 626 teachers from across England, has revealed that more than half of them are in favour of teaching children to take direct action and break the rules in order to make their point on the urgency of the climate crisis. The results revealed that teachers are almost unanimously in favour of an action-focused climate change curriculum to be incorporated across subjects. Currently in England, climate change education is limited to science and geography lessons at secondary school. It doesn't require students to understand the wider impact of climate change on the environment, economy and society. To discuss this survey, I'm delighted to welcome Professor Paul Howard-Jones from the University of Bristol School of Education and Cabot Institute for the Environment. Professor Howard-Jones, were you surprised by the results of this? The teachers seem frustrated that they're not getting their able to get their point across.
Well, I was a little bit surprised, I have to admit. I mean, I think I was expecting teachers to support the idea of engaging students in thinking about and maybe participating in civic action that might include demonstrating, because of course a lot of students already have been doing that. I was a little bit more surprised. We included the option of also including civil disobedience. And yeah, as you say, most teachers also ticked that box and felt that would also be something appropriate to include, at least at Key Stage 4.
That is quite young, isn't it, to start suggesting that children get out on the streets? I mean, have you experienced anything of that equivalent in the past in your career?
Well, I mean, it's not that young. So Key Stage 4 is GCSEs, basically. So that's the sort of age group that you saw coming out on the school protest. And yeah, I mean, there has for a long time been support for teaching citizenship, for example, in schools. Which is all about understanding how change comes about and the legal system and the politics and getting involved with the community. So, yeah, I mean, at young age groups in primary school, we saw teachers supporting ideas like getting involved with conservation projects. And then as the children get older, around sort of primary, secondary transition, this idea that you might start discussing with children about family advocacy, talking to your family about climate change beliefs and what should be done about it, and then later on engaging in the community in community action as well. So, you know, on one hand, I'm not surprised, because we know that there are, well, we believe that there are, you know, reasonable degrees of anxiety amongst children about climate change. And actually, we saw that pouring out onto the streets during those strikes. And being able to do something is one of the ways of addressing anxiety. So I think, you know, it's almost the classic example of a stressful situation is when a child feels that they're worried about something, but there's nothing they can do about it. So in a way, it does make sense for us to be introducing more about climate change education in schools in an action orientated way for the well-being of our children.
I mean, there's a big gap, though, isn't there, between what teachers think is a good idea, albeit that they're on the ground and know, and what the government is likely to do. Can you see this actually being implemented into the curriculum?
Well, you have to remember, maintained schools now are actually academies, so they're not required to follow a national curriculum. And we do know that a large number of schools are extending their climate change education you know, but of course, you know, it's not a separate subject on its own. There are many challenges, and you have to teach it across subjects. And I think, you know, there are all sorts of those sorts of barriers that actually are preventing schools from going further with it. But we know that these sorts of things are happening in schools already. There were teachers that I know who actually under the directives of their head teacher took their children down to the protests, for example. I mean, it's a part of civic society getting involved in that sort of action, I think you can argue.
I understand that teachers can get involved. Where they have, would you expect any kind of pushback from parents about it? Do you think parents are on board as well?
I mean, I think from what I understand in the United States, this has been a lot more controversial than it has here. I think we do have to be careful about this, because it shouldn't be a case that teachers are imposing their political beliefs on children. But I do think it's the case that children need to be supported in thinking about how they bring about change and how they draw attention to their views and opinions in a responsible way, and engage in the very important debates that are going on at the moment. And remember that climate change has been cited as the defining issue, you know, of our time by the United Nations. And so, you know, it seems really, you know, more than appropriate that there should be some significant attention paid to it in the school curriculum. And I think we are seeing that now, but generally through the efforts of individual schools and individual teachers. I think it's notable, for example, amongst the themes in COP26 that the British government, you know, has been involved in drawing up, has led the drawing up of, that actually education is not mentioned. But, you know, we're going to be seeing such changes having to take place as a result of climate change. It seems absurd that we're not preparing those generations that are going to be feeling the effects of this most, that are going to be most caught up in those political changes, those policy changes, that we're not preparing them actually at school to think about these things and engage in debate and, yes, to actually begin to have a role in those changes.
I take all your points, though, but isn't there a slight problem here in that it's a bit like religious education, that there has to be some sort of input about people who don't believe in that, isn't there? I mean, what happens
to
them?
Absolutely. So I think the sorts of things that you might see, for example, we know that deliberative discussion is a very important element of climate change education. So classroom debates, for example, about what should happen about it. I mean, you could imagine a debate in a school about, you know, whether meat, for example, should be completely excluded from the menu. Now, you know, I can see that generating some discussion. and that's the sort of thing that should be happening, preparing children to think about the issues, to be able to argue the issues and reach, you know, consensus on them. So, I don't think it's an issue. I don't think it's a matter of imposing beliefs or anything. I think it's actually a matter of listening to children, support, giving them platforms for them to engage in discussion and debate and to be supported in going forward and taking actions that are responsible. So, I mean, if for example, I mean, we don't really know, of course, what teachers mean when they say they want to teach civil disobedience. It may be, at the very least, that we should be talking about what civil disobedience is and what the consequences are of getting involved with it. I mean, it's not about breaking the law and expecting there to, you know, not to be prosecuted. And actually, possibly in schools, we're talking more about breaking school rules, you know. And if you walk out of your classroom because you want to join a climate strike, there will be consequences for that. It doesn't mean that it's not a moral thing to do. It's not reasonable. It's not rational. But you will still, you know, still likely to get a detention or something later on as a result, or whatever consequences arise. So I think it's actually, because students are already getting involved, they're already becoming active, it's actually the sensible thing for us to do, to be discussing these issues with children and supporting them to, you know, in a way to act and to do things responsibly.
I tell you what, the school's a lot more interesting these days than it was in my time. Thanks so
Some
much.
Some of them
to...
are.
Thanks so much, Professor Paul Howard Jones of the University of Bristol. Well, now it's time for our regular roundup of city and financial matters with Hugo Duncan, Deputy Business Editor of the Daily Mail. Hugo, another British company being stalked by a private equity group. It's becoming a bit of a familiar tale, this, isn't it?
It is indeed, Jim. There seems to be a bid almost every week, and has been for some time now. One of the issues, of course, is that the pandemic has left companies vulnerable, and these private equity bidders, many of them from all over the world, including America, are flush with cash. So today we have St Modwen Properties, which is a FTSE 250 listed property company in Britain. Its board has agreed to be taken over by Blackstone in a £1.25 billion deal.
Blackstone, isn't that the thing that the previous chancellor was involved in?
No, that was BlackRock. It's a different,
right.
company.
I'm libelling him on air, am I?
Indeed. Blackstone is one of the largest private equity companies in the world. As I said, I mean, they're financially very, very strong indeed. Now, the big issue with these private equity companies is exactly what they want to do. Why are they interested? And one of the problems that many critics believe is that these deals are often fueled by debt. These companies are often in to make money over quite a short time period rather than invest for the long term. This can involve selling off assets to try and make a profit. It can involve job cuts. Many private equity firms do invest and make these companies better, but that is not always the way it has been. And there is particular concern at the moment because, as you mentioned, there has been deal after deal after deal, or at least bid after bid after bid. Only this week we had a £5.5 billion bid for Morrisons. Now, Asda, one of the other major supermarket chains in this country, has already been bought by private equity. Now they are circling Morrisons. It raises huge questions over who may be next. And indeed, it's not just St Modwen, Morrisons, Asda who have been targeted. Since the pandemic struck, we've had the AA has been bought by private equity. G4S, that huge security company that people will know, has also been bought by private equity. It goes further than that. Infrastructure companies like John Lang have also gone. As I said, there is almost a deal or a bid or an approach every week.
Are you personally alarmed by all this, Hugo? I mean, you spoke about the potential they have for making quick profits by divesting themselves of parts of the company. Are you alarmed that this is going to have a wider and more significant effect on the economy?
Well, I think there is reason for alarm. I don't think we should tar private equity with the same brush and all of it say it's evil. Far from it. But there have been a number of high profile cases recently of companies that are bought by private equity and then either they are broken up and sold on for profit, or they are, say, a few years later returned to the stock market. Such was the case of Debenhams. Now, when Debenhams came back to the stock market, its debts, are after being owned by private equity, its debts were absolutely vast. And of course, we all know what happened there. There'd been a shortage of investment, and eventually, with the changing face of the high street and the pandemic, it just could not survive. These companies employ vast numbers of people. I think if I was working for one of these companies that was targeted by private equity, you would want to know exactly what their plan was. And one of the issues is that these private equity companies are quite secretive. When companies are listed on the stock market, as St Modwen is, as Morrisons is, as G4S is, they are under a duty to reveal quite a lot of information about what they're up to, because they have shareholders, they have investors. Now, whether that's a big pension fund or whether it's you or I in our ISA, that they do have to reveal quite a lot of information about what they're up to, what their plans are, and so on. Private equity companies are far more secretive, and it is far harder to find out what they're doing. And one of the things that seems to be the case is the people at the top of the private equity companies who buy these companies do end up making an awful lot of money. Now, as I say, sometimes they are a great success, but on far too many occasions, for many people's liking, private equity ownership leaves companies very, very vulnerable.
Really interesting. Thanks very much indeed, Hugo Duncan, Deputy Business Editor of the Daily Mail. The antivirus software pioneer John McAfee, who died from an apparent suicide in a Spanish jail cell on Wednesday, sent a cryptic tweet last year that if he was found hanged behind bars like Jeffrey Epstein, it would be no fault of mine. McAfee was named in a 10-count federal indictment in a Tennessee court in October and charged with evading millions of dollars in income taxes. He was arrested by Spanish authorities that month and jailed pending a decision on his extradition. Now, McAfee is best known for developing the antivirus software in the 1980s that bears his name and that we all bought into. And he helped pioneer instant messaging in the 1990s. He sold his shares in the software company a couple of years after that and reportedly made $100 million, though he told ABC News that I wasted it like everybody who has money. To find out more, let's speak to Caramel Quinn, a leading writer on consumer technology. Caramel, tell us about John McAfee. Eccentric's a bit of an understatement, isn't it?
He was clearly quite a character, and the technology world is definitely a bit less interesting today without him. He's a household name. I mean, interesting enough, he sold off his antivirus software, to Intel in 2010, and they rebranded it and called it Intel. And then a few years later, they rebranded it back because people had the sort of familiarity with McAfee. When they first rebranded it, he said this amazing thing. He said, "I am now everlastingly grateful to Intel for freeing me from this terrible association with the worst software on the planet," was what he actually said about it. You know, never a dull moment.
But his personal life was quite interesting, wasn't it?
Sketchy, certainly. He went into hiding in Central America for a few years. He was about to be extradited back to the US for tax fraud. So all sorts of murky things going on. There's actually a very interesting tech story about him when he was in exile, though. So when he was in exile in Central America, he fled from Belize to Guatemala in a secret location. And then the magazine Vice went and visited him and wrote an article about the fact that they visited him, and there's a photograph of the editor-in-chief of Vice posing with him, and lo and behold, people could figure out where he was because of the photograph, because when we take photos on our smartphones, the location data is usually embedded in the file, and so all the nerds of the world just went straight onto the picture and they could pinpoint exactly where he was, which was just incredible for a tech expert.
He was obviously a pioneer, but how big was he in the tech world? How important was he?
He's a household name in the tech world, in the tech industry and sort of in the households generally. But obviously he went from thing to thing. So more recently, he was very interested in sort of cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin mining and things like that, which is the latest buzzword. So I think some of the tax fraud issues might have related to those things.
He was also a very paranoid man. I think some of his personal habits didn't help that. Do you think any of that was founded in reality?
He ran for president twice. Great enthusiasm, his passion for freedom and privacy. So he's an old school kind of techie nerd who was very much in favor of technology, but was a bit paranoid, I suppose, about the tech giants knowing all of our personal information, as many of us are concerned about. So he was quite a kind of an underground hero for being a public name, but someone who was willing to speak up and say, "I don't really want all my business all over the internet." Ironically, for someone whose business was all over the internet.
He provoked this by what he said towards the end. But do you expect to hear some conspiracy theories wrapping themselves up around his taking his own life?
He was famous enough, and there were so many sketchy stories that I imagine that many people will never be satisfied with what truly happened. It's ripe for conspiracy theories, but whatever happened, it was clearly tragic.
Oh, my thanks to Caramel Quinn there, a leading writer on consumer technology, about the very elusive John McAfee. That's it for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. All this week at 5 p.m, you can listen to me all over again. I'm Jim White, standing in for Andrew Pearce, who's off on a well-earned staycation. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, have yourselves a great evening. Goodbye.